Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations. Wow, it's not even October yet, and we're already starting with some Halloween-friendly content. Karen helped us get an interview with Jeffrey Reddick, who you might know from his screenplay for the film Final Destination. More recently, he made a movie called Dead Awake, which dealt with a fatally contagious form of sleep paralysis. I think this episode's a fun pop culture break, but we do talk about horror films, murder, death, sex, fear. In other words, this content might not be suitable for young children.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner. Is that recording too?
All right, we're good. Oh, welcome back. It's been a busy couple of weeks.
It always is. Yeah. But this is great. We're going to be talking to Jeffrey Reddick today.
Yeah, I guess he's not our second. Maybe he's like our third screenwriter.
We spoke to Richard Haydn recently too.
I think most of our listeners enjoy horror monsters and every now and then to sort of step away from intense skepticism and just talk about, you know, the sort of pop culture stuff is a fun relief from, you know, intense critical thinking about whether things are real.
The drudgery of Bigfoot all the time.
Oh, poor old Bigfoot. So I just got back from CryptidCon, and it was really fun talking with people who, I mean, I'll be blunt, it was fun talking to a lot of believers because they remind you of, like, you know, it's really easy if you become skeptical about this stuff to kind of forget how magical and fun it is.
I love hearing the stories.
Or terrifying. I mean, there were people there who've had very frightening experiences. We talked to one guy who had gone out into the woods in Kentucky to camp, and he had some experiences that scared him so bad, he just dumped his camping equipment and took off and left it. And he's been basically too rattled to go back and pick up his gear. And I was like, wow, I wish I had time to go help, you know, not just to get his gear, but just to take a look around and see kind of what he was experiencing. So,
When you talk to people like that, you believe them, not necessarily their theories, but certainly something happened, and their stories are certainly interesting to hear about. And I mean, us being skeptics, we always look for natural explanations, though.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times we don't get to give them because sometimes there's not enough evidence or it's a one-time thing, you know.
And yeah, the question marks are okay.
Within the limits of what we can experiment on our test, I think it's fun to dig in. Although, again, some people don't appreciate that, and I always want to be respectful for people who want to take the time to share their story. And I like today's topic. We'll be talking about horror movies and
sleep paralysis
and death and some other sort of macabre topics. Yeah.
Different kinds of monsters with this topic as well.
Yeah, so this should be really interesting.
Your standard monsters, yeah.
Monster Dog.
I just got back from Kentucky. I was talking to Karen about it, and I guess that's where you're from originally?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What part did you go to?
I went to Frankfort, which looked like it's an hour and a half from where you were from, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's so funny, because most people just go to Lexington or Louisville, so anytime I hear anybody that goes anywhere outside of those two areas, I'm very impressed because that's like real Kentucky.
It's a beautiful state, and it's funny in Frankfort because I still feel like it's part of the Bible Belt, yet there's whiskey manufacturers everywhere, so you can smell the mash all over the place. It's crazy.
I was going to say, well, is it a dry county?
Yeah. It's some counties are still dry, and but a lot of them are wet. So it's a very interesting dichotomy living there about, you know, about what's Bible Belty and what's not.
Where do you live now?
Fine.
Yeah. Are you in L.A.?
California.
California, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I live in California. I've been here for almost 18 years now.
Oh.
So I lived in New York before that for 11 years. I'm kind of dating myself now, but.
Well, you and I are almost the same age if your IMDb is correct. So, yeah.
It's correct.
Yeah.
I was going to change it, but I'm like, screw it. I'm going to age gracefully.
Oh, you're young. Don't worry about it.
If you don't mind, could you introduce yourself a little bit? I mean, we could talk about the movies you've done in the intro, but.
I would describe myself as a writer, actor, producer, director. I would go, I'm like a multi-hyphenate now. or creative dude, whichever is easier, whichever one sounds less pretentious.
I don't know if you want to avoid pretension in Hollywood, though. Isn't a lot of it based on representation,
based on that,
like you having your character, you know?
Well, now,
yeah.
Well, now we have Facebook to be pretentious on and Twitter, so you can just be more yourself when you're talking to people.
You've worked with some really famous movies like the Final Destination series and Day of the Dead, the remake, and more recently Dead Awake, and you're working on a number of other projects currently.
Yeah. I've got a lot of fun like genre stuff in the works.
So, Jeffrey, all of your movies seem to have paranormal, supernatural themes, so correct me if I'm wrong there, but how did you become interested in the paranormal?
It really was through movies growing up. When I was young, I started watching horror films, and I just tended to, you know, my favorite horror film was Nightmare on Elm Street, which kind of dealt with kind of a person who could get to you through your dreams. I always joke that the only time that I've ever experienced anything that I'm 100% sure was paranormal is when my grandmother died. And I remember sitting in the living room or the kitchen with my family, and out of the corner of my eye, like I saw something walk up behind me and and I knew it was her. Like, and I put her hand on my shoulder, and I just told my mom, I said, "Oh, grandma just touched me." And I wasn't scared. And I, to this day, I just know it was her. Cause I just religiously, I do believe like there's a, you know, an afterlife and that, you know, our spirit lives on after we do, but that's the only time I've ever experienced it. So part of me is like, I wish I had more paranormal stories to tell, because I write horror all the time and I go to creepy places, but just from that one experience with my grandmother, and just also, it's just kind of a lot of the coincidences that I see in life that are just too many to be coincidences. I just know that I know that we're all connected on a level much deeper than we realize, you know, and we can kind of tell from just our senses. But you know, I've always been fascinated by darker stories. Part of it's where I grew up. You know, I grew up in I always bring this up, not to be a downer, but I grew up in an area that wasn't very racially enlightened back in the day. Like, my mother's white and my father's black. So, you know, we faced a lot of racism growing up. And a lot of what I did was escape into reading fantasy, you know, Greek mythology, horror stories. You know, I had a group of friends that we would just watch horror films all the time. And a lot of times, you know, I always dreamed about leaving the hills and being a movie star. And I had a very rich fantasy life. And so that helped me kind of escape. Yeah, it's
you
funny.
Succeeded.
Like, it is funny. Like one of my cousins told me when I was like 7 or 8, she asked me what I was going to do when I grew up. And I said, I'm going to be a movie star. And it's, you know, I wanted to be an actor. That was my original dream. But this was before non-traditional casting was a thing in New York. And they just didn't know what to do with me. My agent was like, well, you can't rap and you can't play basketball, so I could maybe get you on The Cosby Show. And they canceled The Cosby Show. And so I was like, well, there goes my acting career. So wow. I started writing. Yeah. Those were good times back
Wait,
in the day.
Wait, but you fell into writing? But by like coming around from not being able to get the acting gigs?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote on the – English was my best subject, so I was writing on the side. Is kind of a fun hobby, but once I realized the acting wasn't going to happen like I wanted it to, then I dove into writing full-time. And at first I was like, I'm going to write a part for myself, and then I kept writing about killing teenagers, and then I quit being a teenager and got older, and I'm like, well – I could play a teenager on the CW because you can be in your 30s and get away with that. But Yeah, I decided that, you know, I've kind of dipped my toe back into acting a little bit, but writing, yes. I still love writing.
Well, yeah, you were actually in this film, right? So, yeah.
There's a cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little cameo in Dead Awake. I have a new film coming out that I can't announce yet, but it'll be announced probably in the next week because we're getting into festival. But I have a little role in that, and I've kind of started to give myself more role. I did a movie 200 hours and gave my, and I got a cameo in that too. So it's just fun to do it. Yeah. It's just to keep that itch scratched a little bit. And
well, how much do you have to, I guess the Screenwriters Guild is different from the Screen Actors Guild, right? So like,
yeah.
Can you be in both?
Yeah, you can be in all the unions.
Okay.
Which is cool. And, you know, I've been fortunate in a lot of the films that I've been in where a lot of them have been done independently and I've been involved. So, you know, I get along, you know, with all my directors I've gotten along with. And, yeah, I've just been fortunate enough to, you know, sometimes be able to slip myself into a small role. And I let them know pretty early on. I'm like, hey, I wrote this part for myself. And usually it's only a couple of lines. It's nothing massive. So,
well, quick question. This is really sort of tangential, but I'm from Georgia and we're all almost the same age. And I noticed that your accent doesn't sound like most of the people I talk to in Kentucky. Did you have to work to change your accent or is this just how you talk?
No, I had to work to change it.
I had to work to change mine quite a bit. And of course, if I talk to my parents, it just comes right back to redneck. Yeah.
Yeah. If I get on the phone with my family or I don't drink anymore, but if I got drunk, back in the day, it would come out really quickly. So it don't take much to get it.
There you go. That's just exactly the same. My wife can my wife can walk into the room if I've been on the phone with my mom or dad. She's like, okay, who were you talking to, your mom or your dad? Because it's just like, it takes me about 30 minutes to shake it. So
Yeah. So I can turn it on and I can turn it off pretty quick. So, but yeah, I did learn in college. I took a lot of diction.
This again, not really monster related or anything, but you're mentioning about the growing up in a biracial family in the South. You're like a few months older than me. And I remember growing up, like, you know, just what a nightmare it was for interracial couples around here. And I just hated it, you know, and I didn't understand it. And now it seems like it's a much better thing. But I mean, it was even illegal to get married, you know, not that long ago. And it's just amazing how much transformation's happened in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it was amazing for me just to kind of see the kind of evolution of that. And also my mom was really good in that she was very mindful to bring us up to understand that. You know, the people just didn't know any better. You know, she's like, they're ignorant, not ignorant as in education, but just ignorant as, you know, they hadn't seen this before and people are afraid of something that they haven't seen before. So she taught us to be very patient, which is why I think I've been able to kind of navigate racism better than, you know what I'm saying? And not fall into so much anger. And I can kind of deal with, you know, I can kind of talk to people on both sides of the issue to try to find some common ground, because I think we're in such a society now where, you know, everybody's just yelling at everybody and nobody wants to take the time to actually understand other people. You know, so that's a whole other thing. But I think there's a lot more human monsters that I faced than supernatural ones.
Well, that's been my experience too. Yeah. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was reading about you online, preparing for this, I read the story about how you sort of broke it. I guess there's a story out there about how you broke into screenwriting, but what you're telling me is that you were aspiring to be an actor. And I know everybody's more complicated than the little bullet points you see on, you know, Wikipedia or IMDb. Can you tell us about the sort of the trajectory that got you into screenwriting?
The story, I know the story you're talking about, which is pretty awesome. When I saw the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie, which to this day is still my favorite horror movie of all time, I was 14 years old and, you know, living in Kentucky. And I went home and I wrote a prequel idea on my little typewriter with my onion paper. And I sent it to Bob Shea, who ran New Line Cinema in New York. And he sent the story back and he's like, we don't take unsolicited material. So I wrote him back and I was like, look, mister, I've spent $3 on your movies and I think you can take 5 minutes to read my story.
And put on here.
Yeah. And he did, you know, this is like something only a 14-year-old hillbilly would do, yeah. Actually. But he read it and he got back to me and was very encouraging. And his assistant, Joy Mann, who became like a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. She's no longer with us, but her and Bob stayed friends with me from the age of 14 to 19 when I went to New York to study acting for the summer. And they gave me an internship at New Line. And, you know, I ended up working at New Line for 11 years. And wow. They bought Final Destination. Yeah. So it's definitely one of those. It's not one of those, oh, I was an actor who somebody saw at a soda shop. But it's definitely a cool story because Bob could have just not read my story. I think I would have still ended up in the business one way or the other. But I think that obviously jump-started me and got me in at the studio.
Good on you. And encouragement matters so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wasn't even playing, you know, you never, when you're 14, you're not thinking like, I lived in a trailer in Kentucky. I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to network. You know, I was not thinking any of that. I was just like, I have a good story and you should read it. Like, why wouldn't you read it? It's really good. It wasn't very good when I look back on it.
Oh, God, I look at things I've written even 5 years ago and think that was crap.
I know, but I was tenacious.
But reminder to listeners, you just keep hammering at it. You get better by doing, not by thinking about it, right?
So absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So speaking about Nightmare on Elm Street, and several of your movies seem to deal with the topic of sleep phenomena, such as sleep paralysis and sleep deprivation. So have you had any personal experiences with sleep issues?
I had sleep paralysis a couple of times, but it was very minor. It was just I couldn't move. And, you know, I felt something was in the room with me. But it wasn't – again, I wish I had more scary stories because I sound so boring. It's so funny. But I've just had the mild case of sleep paralysis. I certainly have those common dreams like where you're falling and, you wake up right before you hit the ground. And, you know, my worst dream is when I'm like winning an Academy Award and I'm all happy and I'm hanging out with all the stars. And then I wake up and I'm like, oh, that's my worst nightmare.
We've spoken about sleep paralysis a lot on the show, and Blake has had some real doozies, haven't you?
I have. But yeah. It was really, in a very real sense, my gateway into becoming sort of a skeptical person because I realized a lot of this sort of paranormal stuff ties to real world, you know, psychological phenomena. But I only learned that by doing a lot of reading, and I had to sort of get out of the bubble of paranormal literature to find that stuff. But I still love, yeah, it did take a while. I actually think about it, as you build up your personality and memories and stuff, it's kind of an accretive process. You come to develop beliefs and ideas, and there's not really a corresponding ablative process for like wiping away ideas that are no good when you realize they aren't. So they're still there waiting for you, and you have to sort of build new structures to sort of handle these things. That's sort of my working model anyway. So all that stuff's there, working, you know, lurking under the hood somewhere, ready to be fired back up at the slightest provocation. You know, late at night, you hear somebody walking behind you when you're coming up the stairs, and suddenly you're running up the stairs despite your bad knees because you're in your late 40s. You know, it happens.
It does. Those knees, I do. Yeah.
Knees.
You know, we're going to talk a little bit about your 2016 film Dead Awake, which I watched to prepare for this interview, and I have to confess that when I watched it, I mistook the Tower of the Americas for the Sky Needle, and I thought at one point that everybody was in Seattle, but then they're going to drive to Austin to go interview a guy. I was like, how are they driving to Austin from Seattle? And so I looked it up on IMDb and saw that you'd actually filmed in San Antonio. So here's my question: did the director forget the Alamo?
I never thought about that, actually.
That's okay. I just wanted to throw out the "did you forget the Alamo" joke, so I'm okay now. But
any opportunity. But Dead Awake is a really fun movie. It's it's great to see a thriller that's more about suspense than blood and gore that you see in a lot of horror films.
Thank you. And it's a fascinating, you know, like I didn't know a lot about it until I started studying it. And then I didn't realize like that it did tie into a lot of things, like, you know, people think alien abductions is really tied into that. And there's just, you know, demonic possession. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, in ancient times that were kind of tied into this phenomenon. A lot of people, once I started talking about it, a lot of people had actually experienced it. So it was a fun project to write just because, you know, I love writing about stuff that have roots in real life phenomena, but, you know, where there's kind of like a scientific reason behind it, but then there's also a supernatural reason behind it. So you get to, it's kind of fun to explore both sides of an issue. So that was a lot of fun with this movie.
How did Dead Awake come about? I mean, were you commissioned to write this, or did you write it on your own and shop it around? How did that happen?
Yeah, no, I had some producers bring me some articles on sleep paralysis, just to kind of introduce me to the idea of it. And and they were like, we were trying to think of a story for this. And so I kind of went off and, you know, obviously when you're dealing with a movie about dreams and you can't move, like, you know, my Nightmare on Elm Street stuff, you know, my synapses like went crazy. But I wanted to kind of keep it away from Nightmare. But then it's funny because a lot of this stuff in the movie reflects Nightmare on Elm Street. And a lot of it was unintentional. Like some of the set pieces and scenery and locations are very evocative of Nightmare on Elm Street, which were totally not in the script. And then there were things in the script that I put in there as homages. And so it just turned out to be a lot of Nightmare on Elm Street influence in the movie that was intentional and unintentional. You know, with writing especially, you know, they always ask, you know, why is this happening to this character and why now? And, you know, if you're dealing with an evil that's been around forever, then you have to answer the question like, well, why doesn't everybody who's ever had sleep paralysis die in their sleep? And so the answer, spoiler, I should say, so cover your ears for 15 seconds if you don't want to know. But no, the reason I kind of came into, well, I can say this without spoiling it. I came into the story where, you know, the idea was you have to start believing in this entity before it will come after you. And so I came up with a way for a character who would normally not believe in it to experience it. And then the more she starts investigating it and starts convincing her friends it's real, they start believing in it. So it kind of starts spreading like a virus amongst her friends. Yeah, that didn't spoil anything.
And I mean, I don't think, have we really talked about whether, we've talked about sleep paralysis a lot, have we spoken about whether people have died from it or not? Because in some of the cases that inspired Nightmare on Elm Street, weren't people dying?
There was
the Loations, I think.
Absolutely right, the Loations. Yeah, there were a group of them that all died in their sleep, and they had all reported seeing something in their sleep, and that inspired Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street. And I don't know, they've never been able to explain that either. So that, you know, that is creepy.
So, Blake, do you know anything about that angle of?
I had read that before, but I never really investigated or dug in historically into the backstory.
I think they might have been dying from heart attacks or strokes associated with sleep paralysis.
I don't know. There's so many legends about sleeping in general. You know, I mean, even when I was a kid, people were like, well, if you die in your dream, you die in real life. You know, like, well, you know, how would you know? But I mean,
yeah. Well, yeah. Wes Craven even said that, you know, he'd read an article about a young man who had been telling his family that something was after him in his sleep. And they were just like, don't worry about it, you're fine. And he died in his sleep. And that kind of, that got the germ of the idea in his head for Nightmare on Elm Street. And then he had some weird guy that was like standing under a street lamp, like looking at his window when he was a kid, that scared the crap out of him. And the guy had kind of a trench coat, I think, and a fedora. And that's kind of what is, I know, it's like perverts. Creepy. Yeah, perverts are good for something, at least. Nightmares and movies. give them at least they're useful. Yeah, they're useful for a little bit of something. But that's what really kind of inspired the look for Freddy Krueger in Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, it's interesting. I mean, speaking of, like, coincidences, but the night that we finished filming, and again, there are like, some definite unintentional homages to Nightmare on Elm Street in the movie. But the night that we finished shooting, the next day I went to bed and I woke up the next day and my phone was blowing up and I thought something horrible had happened to somebody involved in the film. And it was people calling to say that Wes Craven died.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like, it was, that was very, that's just one of those things that's just like, you know, he was such an important influence in my life. And
yeah,
it was just a weird, the timing was just weird on that, you know, another one of those like kind of coincidences that's almost too coincidental to not notice. Yeah.
Did you get to know him or did you ever get to meet him in your career?
I did get to meet him. The embarrassing thing is I had about five chances to meet him at New Line and I was too embarrassed to go up and talk to him because I knew I would geek out. I just knew that I would like geek out. And finally I went to a premiere for the Last House on the Left remake, and I can't remember who the actor was. I was talking to an actor. I was like, yeah, I really want to meet Wes. He's like, oh, I'll take you over to meet him. And I was like, oh, and of course, by this point, I'm like a grown-ass man. I should just go meet Wes Craven. So he took me over to meet him, and Wes was just like, he was so nice and so humble. And we talked for like, you know, probably half an hour. And it was like really amazing just to speak with him. And I joked because we did a DVD together for New Line called The House That Freddy Built. And he came in right after my interview. And I told him, I was like, I really wanted to talk to you, but I was too embarrassed. He's like, you should have talked to me. Like there's, you know, but yeah, he's just reading everything about him. I mean, he was such a smart man. He was a teacher, you know, and I admire teachers greatly. And he was just really smart. And yeah, he's just an amazing filmmaker and just a humble, generous man from everything that I've heard. So yeah, definitely a good role model if you want to have a role model, I think, in the business, personally and creatively.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, good that you finally met him then.
Yes.
I wouldn't be too embarrassed, but you geek out sometimes. It happens. I met Bernie Wrightson one time, and I, you know, I'm an idiot, but it was like, I didn't expect it, but you know, just the next thing you know, you're talking a mile a minute and talking about how inspiring and everything, you know, it's just
starstruck.
Yeah. So
I've only been starstruck one time. And because when I worked at New Line, like they would have a lot of celebrities come in and, you know, you just had to be professional. Mm-hmm. The only time that I got starstruck is, remember the V miniseries?
Yes.
The original, Jane Badler, who played Diana in V, she was the evil, like, scientist who murdered everybody and was just awesome. I got to meet her maybe 5 years ago, and we got together for coffee because I wanted her to be in my short. And she lives in Australia, and she came over to LA, and we had coffee. And I was literally I couldn't speak. I was like, oh, this is what starstruck feels like because I can't even talk right now. And so I had to tell her. And she was just adorable. She was like, that's adorable. But I've met like Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, like all these super big people. And I'm just like, hey, nice to meet you. Morgan Freeman was almost starstruck, but not quite. But with Jane Badler, I could not even speak for like 5 minutes. It was humiliating.
Wow. Yeah. It's wild because, you know, with actors, it's, you know, so much of it comes out of, some of it comes from the craft. Like if I met Robert De Niro, I'd be like, oh my gosh, what a great actor, right? You know, but right. If I met Bruce Campbell, I'd be like, oh my God, Ash, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's not an insult. That's not an insult. That's just also because they're such important characters to you. Like for me, like growing up, Nightmare on Elm Street and V were like the two biggest things in my life. Like, you know, movie-wise and TV-wise, those projects were so important to me. And Robert Englund was in both of them.
He was. I forgot about that. He was like the sort of friendly, lovable reptile.
He was a lovable reptile that didn't want to eat people.
Yeah.
Willie, he played Willie.
That's right.
So when you meet people that are such iconic characters, too, like you're not even saying they're not as good as actors as anybody else. It's just their role is what's made them iconic. Like Robert De Niro has been in so many films. It's just like, you've been in so many films. You're awesome. But like when you meet Freddy Krueger, you're like, holy shit, it's Freddy Krueger.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So you touched upon this a little bit earlier. When we were talking about Dead Awake, you said that when you were doing your research that people started telling you about their stories.
Yes.
Their experiences. So after the movie was released, did you get a lot of people coming up to you and telling you about their experiences with sleep paralysis?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot. And it was amazing, you know, because they say that one in three people will experience it at some point in their life, and not necessarily the whole, you know, some demon sitting on your chest, horrific experience, but mm-hmm. some level of it. And I've had so many people come up to me since the film, talking about it. And it's, you just don't realize how prevalent something is in society. Most people, a lot of people are like, oh, I was embarrassed to say anything because I thought it was just, you know, I was crazy or it was just weird and you would think I was weird or, you know, and so it's interesting that there are these things that we all have happen to us that we're afraid to talk about until we maybe see it in a film and we realize, oh, it's more common than we think. So I've had a lot of people come, but some people have told me some really freaky stories, you know, like one of my friends woke up and could swear that he was like upside down, like in an inverted cross over his bed and something was like crawling in the room after him. So I wanted to actually steal that for a movie, but I haven't figured out that. I'll thank him in any interviews I do, but when I steal that, but
you have to use really, that is scary.
It was very creepy.
Was it all grist for the mill, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
So I saw online that you've been to a lot of horror conventions. Can you talk about your involvement in sort of the horror culture scene, or is that something that it seems like that's grown during our lifetime?
I think it has grown. I mean, I will say this, and anybody that works in the genre will tell you this, like the horror community is like probably the most like loyal, passionate community that you will ever find in your life. Like, you know, you don't see like romantic comedy conventions.
Good point.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, especially growing up, you know, horror has always been kind of the black sheep of the film industry. And it's just ridiculous because horror has always, you know, from Psycho to The Exorcist, to, you know, going into Night of the Living Dead and Halloween. And, you know, you've always had such benchmark films in the horror genre that have made such an impression. And it makes a lot of money for the business. But for some reason, you know, people like to be snobby about their art. So, you know, it's one of those genres that doesn't really get the respect it deserves. And even when it makes a ton of money, in Hollywood, especially, money talks. But, you know, people have a weird, you know, they just don't look at it as the art form that the horror fans know that it is. So I love going to conventions is one of the most fun things for me in the world because you get to meet the fans and, you know, they just know so much about your work and they, you know, especially as a writer, they appreciate that. Like Hollywood's very, you know, once the director started wanting to get like possessive credit on films where it's like, it's a film by blah, 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 you know, everybody started kind of really focusing their attention on directors and actors. And as somebody who's got a theater background, you know, I was always brought up to believe, you know, like the play is the foundation for everything. Mm-hmm. And so you find that in television, but in movies, because it's gotten a lot, you know, more ego driven and who's out there in the public eye, that, you know, the focus has kind of really shifted to the actors and the director. And so the writers are kind of in movies, especially they're kind of the low man and woman on the totem pole. Which is just funny because, you know, they need your script to make anything. And so when you go to conventions, that's one place I find, I always joke, I'm like, that's where the fans, like, that's where you get, like, most of the attention. Not that you do this for attention, but you get the kind of, I hate to say respect too, but I'll say it. You get the kind of respect that writers should get. You know, like, if I were to meet a great playwright, I wouldn't be knocking it out of the way to get to an actor. I'd be, like, talking to the playwright. So it's fun to go to conventions and really connect with the fans. And it's especially when you see like younger, because I started watching these movies when I was way too young to be watching them. And, you know, my mom was like, hey, you're not out doing drugs or doing anything bad. So if you and your dorky, they're not dorky, they're awesome. But me and I had my friend Tony and Calvin that I grew up with. And like, if you and your friends are going to be hanging out like a bunch of dorks watching horror movies and reading comic books all the time, that's better than getting in trouble. So my mom always let us watch those movies, even though she'd be like, I don't know how you can watch that nasty stuff, but she would still let us watch it.
We were in the blockbuster age, you know?
Oh, yes.
So just roaming the horror of, you know, what's new? Yeah.
And we had a video store and where the guy knew us so well that he would like let us rent R-rated horror films. He'd be like, just don't tell anybody.
Yeah. So
we would always like rent the scariest, bloodiest films we could find. And so it's really fun when you go to conventions and you meet young people and their parents will sometimes bring them up embarrassed, you know, because their kids are like 15 or whatever. And they're like, yeah, let him watch your movies. But he really wants to be a writer or she really wants to be a writer. And I'm like, you're doing fine. They're not going to. It's the romantic comedy writers you have to watch out for. They turn out to be crazy.
Well, I kept thinking about your idea. There's no romantic comedy conventions. And of course not. Who's going to watch The Cats? So
yeah. I bet there are. Someone's going to write to us.
I know.
Someone's going to write to us and say you're
wrong. Touché. Yes. Yeah. There probably is a romantic comedy convention, and then somebody's going to be like,
yeah,
how dare you say that's all right. Romantic comedy.
Well, here's a confession, deep confession. Yeah. All right. I love rom-coms, and my wife doesn't, so I have to go see them by myself.
That is awesome.
It's so sad.
It's kind of like when I go to see horror movies, especially when they're like younger skewing ones, and I'll be like the only person like in my 40s who's there, and then it's like with a bunch of teenagers, and I'm like, people are gonna think I'm a pervert. Like, what's that?
As long as you're not wearing the trench coat.
The trench coat and the fedora.
Exactly. I think it was 99 that The Sixth Sense came out, and I was getting ready to get married, so I was living with my wife, and she didn't want to go. I went to see the movie by myself, and I came home completely creeped out because it's a great ghost story.
Oh my God, yes.
And I got home, and I was like, she was sleeping, and I crawled into bed, and I was like, I want to cuddle because I'm scared. And she just like elbowed me, and I'll never forget what she said, because it really, really sort of set the tone for our marriage. She said, go to sleep, you pussy.
That's Kathleen, right?
That's my wife. Yeah,
awesome.
So she is awesome.
Awesome. So. That is pretty awesome.
She's never been scared of anything that I know of, except for, you know, something happening to our kids. But yeah, right. So I'm the one who's always, I love horror, but always freaked out by it. So yeah.
Yeah, my mom was like that. She's like, you know, grew up on a farm, and you know, she lived to be 97, and she was just tough as. I mean, she'd go out and, like, you know, if she saw a snake, she'd go get a hoe and cut its head off.
Yeah.
You know, she's that kind of mom. Like, she didn't give a. And so, yeah, I would get scared from watching horror films. And I remember I saw Salem's Lot.
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, that one I was too young. My mom actually told me I couldn't watch it, but I snuck down the hallway and watched it from the hallway.
Yeah.
And that scene where Danny Click's trying to get in the window.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's a Tobe Hooper movie. Yeah.
Yeah, scared the crap out of me. And so I had to sleep by my mom's bed for like a week. But my mom and my sister shared like a big bed in her room. So my sister would bring shoes and stuff to bed with her and like throw them at me at night because she knew I couldn't say anything, because if mom found out I was sleeping in the room, she would know I watched a horror movie. So yeah, that's my sister too, in a heartbeat. Like, I'm just gonna throw stuff at Jeffrey all night because he can't do anything.
The joy of family.
Again, this is something you've touched upon a little bit already, but as a horror movie writer, what kinds of things scare you?
It's funny because people have asked me that a lot, and I just always give the honest answer. You know, I get more scared about people, and not just like serial killer stuff, but when I see the ugliness in the world, because again, I've definitely faced like really ugly racism in my life and really ugly homophobia. And when I see how easily it is to stir up hatred, among people for other people, that scares me more than anything else, really, to be honest. I'm not afraid of, you know, because I know how to take care of myself as far as like trying not to put myself in dangerous situations. And so I'm not really worried about serial killers or monsters. I'm really just more worried about, you know, somebody gay bashing me, or, you know, because that's happened before, you know. And,
yeah.
You know, so I'm more worried about things like that than any fake monsters. I don't want to die. I thought about death, and I don't want to have a long agonizing death. I mean, that's something I thought about, but as far as what really scares me, it's really just how easily people can turn on one another and harm one another. That really frightens me.
Wow. So you've had a lot growing up in the South. You had a lot going against you as far as people's biases.
Did that
influence your writing?
I think it influenced my writing to a degree, but it certainly made me identify with, like, you know, kind of people who are geeks and outcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
But I try not to write too many movies with, like, you know, the nerdy kid gets revenge on the popular kids, because I feel like that's a it's an interesting thing. I had a conversation with a friend of mine in college who was like one of the most popular guys in college, and he was really nice to me, and we'd sit and talk for hours, but he was a complete jerk to everybody else. Like, he was just an asshole. He was always picking fights and he was being mean. And I asked him at one time when we were alone, I'm like, well, I said, you're so nice and you're very thoughtful. I'm like, why do you act like that to everybody? And he said, well, the way that I was brought up and being a jock, like, that's what's expected of me. And I know that probably sounds like a cop out, but I got what he was saying in a way. Like, he felt as boxed in by how he was raised and felt he had to act a certain way. And so that's kind of made me a little bit more empathetic, I think. So I try to find layers in my writing, and it doesn't often end up on the screen. Like, that's the first thing they'll cut in a script. Is there like character layers? Screw that. Just make them a dumb jock, or make a, you know, him or her this. But I try to find, like, when I write, I do tend to write strong females, just because that's what I loved about Nightmare on Elm Street as well. And also my mom and having a sister that can kick my butt. But yeah, I think it's more, I think it's made me more, try to write more complex characters in my work. And I think I do tend to kind of deal with horror that's more grounded in stuff that you can relate to, like, you know, obviously dying, you know, is a universal fear, and, you know, dying in your sleep with, you know, dead awake is something I, you know, that really interested me as well. And, you know, Tamara, you know, that was a movie about a girl who was bullied, and who kind of came back and got her comeuppance. But she did it by kind of finding out the flaws of each of her tormentors and using those against them. So, you know, I do try to add some layers to my work. Sometimes it's just zombies eating people, though. You know,
see him.
What are you going to do?
And so, Tamara, I'd say Tamara with my accent, but you were inspired a little by the Carrie movie, by that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've always loved Carrie. Stephen King's one of my favorite writers. He likes Final Destination too. It's in one of his top 10 lists. I know, I was so excited. I haven't got to meet him yet, but I'm going to mention him enough times till it happens.
Oh, happy birthday, Steve. I think he just turned, like, his birthday was like yesterday or something. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I missed it. I was like, damn it. Yeah. But, you know, I love Carrie. My only qualm was that you have to wait to the end of the movie for her to get back at all those people. So for me, when I was writing Tamara, like, you know, because everybody kept saying, write something like Final Destination. So they, you know, it's a high bar in concept, you know, where it's like, come up with something like where it's death, but you don't show death, and you know, and so I was like, let me just write something fun. And nothing is as fun as, like, you know, a bullied kid getting revenge. And then, you know, so I wanted to kind of do something like Carrie, but where she starts getting revenge a lot earlier in the movie. So you don't have to wait till the third act for it to happen. And they watered that movie down. I mean, a friend of mine, Jonathan Doyle, and I wrote a novelization of it that had all the stuff from the script in it. But, you know, in the original movie, like, Chloe, the main female character, was coming out as a lesbian. And they cut that out. So now it's just her and the guy that you keep thinking she's going to end up with just never get together. And you're like, that's weird. You think they would end up together. And it's like, no, she's a lesbian. And, you know, and there was a scene where these two, you know, jocks had been kind of roofing and taking advantage of girls. And Tamara puts a spell on them and basically has the guy, like, they rape the other guy because that's what they'd been doing to girls. And of course they watered that scene down and neutered it. And so there was a lot of, like, stuff that I wanted to push the envelope in a way, but really, you know, have a message behind it as well. So some of that got neutered, but it's a fun movie, and some of the actors in there are some of my favorite people in the world. So yeah, it was kind of my homage to Carrie. Like, if she started kicking ass a lot earlier.
You improved it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, a lot of what King does is rework other people's. I mean, the Shining is pretty much The Haunting of Hill House redone. And a lot of his work is like that. I mean, obviously he's done a lot that is not derivative, but he clearly, a lot of his early novels.
Isn't it?
Well, a lot of his early novels seem like they, you know, it's take an idea. Here's what I would do to turn it to 11, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm not dismissing. Everything is derivative. I shouldn't say derivative. Everything's a mashup is I think.
There's not really any, you can't really, especially if you go back to like studying ancient writings and stuff like that, they're just basic stories that you can kind of tell and kind of you just filter it through your life experiences and your influences and hopefully that's makes it unique. Final Destination, is cool, but it basically is a slasher movie with death as a slasher, powers.
Speaking of Final Destination, the movies have a connection to the X-Files. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's got several, but I originally had that concept, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And then I was trying to get an agent, and they told me I needed to write an X-Files episode. So I wrote, I used the setup about the premonition as an X-Files episode, and I had Charles, who was like Dana's brother that we never really saw. She had one brother we saw a couple times, and then Charles was like, I think we only saw him one time. So I had her brother have the premonition, and I got an agent, but my friend at New Line read the script. He's like, dude, don't send this into the X-Files. Like, write this as a feature. So I ended up writing a feature treatment of the script that I wrote and set it up with some producer friends of mine. And, we tried to set up a New Line like six times. At first, the script was, they were all adults that got off the plane, and then Scream came out and teenagers were hot. So they were like, make them all teenagers. And New Line kept passing on it. And finally, the producers, Craig Perry and Warren Zeid, were like, if you pass on this again, we're going to take it to Miramax. And they're like, we'll buy it. So they bought the story, and I wrote the first draft of the script. But the the karmic thing is James Wong and Glenn Morgan, who worked on a lot of the best X-Files episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Were brought on to rewrite the script and to direct. So it kind of went like X-Files full circle.
What's that like? When you're a writer and you write your script and you know, if you're professional, it's going to get touched and treated by strangers. What does that feel like? Or did you have to work to learn to let go of the sort of emotional attachment to it? Or how does...
Yeah, I think that was probably the biggest blessing of working at New Line for as long as I did, as I saw that process happen so many times. And I learned very early on that a lot of the reasons that scripts were chosen weren't because of the quality of the work, but it was who was attached to it. And there were so many outside forces that I learned to let it go. And I'm very collaborative. Again, I have a theater background. So if somebody has ideas that make the script better, I have no problem with it. Cause I do have writer friends that are very like precious about don't touch a word of the script. And that's fine if that's their thing. But I'm more like if you hire a great actor and they come up with a line and they've really, dug into this character, like let them bring their magic to the table. It only makes the movie better. So I don't mind if it makes the movie better. It's hard when you see people making decisions that you know are going to hurt the film because you just know the genre and sometimes that part is hard. You also sometimes receive ego on the other end where, people, the directors or somebody will come in and not want to give you credit at all for the work that you've done.
Yeah.
Even when it was your original idea. So sometimes you have to kind of deal with that political stuff, which can actually taint a project for you. And it's, that's kind of harder to let go of, is when somebody tries to discredit the work that you've done, opposed to just being like, hey, we've come on and we've done our thing with this, but you do learn to let it go. It still stings a little bit. That's one of the reasons I moved more into producing and I'm moving into directing now, is because I have a couple of projects that I'm like, nobody's touching this one, except for me. And if it turns out awful, then fine. But I have my vision for it, and I know how.
Yeah, you can sing "I Did It My Way" at the end, no matter what, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I'll sing that song.
that word "precious." I mean, that captures a lot of what I see. I'm always thinking about the writing process myself, and it's like what inspires you to write and like get down to business and get past that blank sheet of paper. Can you mention that or talk about that? I mean, like what gets you typing even when you don't really feel like it?
Well, it's funny because this has been one of those weeks where I feel exhausted and I haven't been able to write. So, I mean, my friends are like, you sound depressed, because it's just like one of those weeks where I just haven't been able to do it. So I've just been taking naps this week. Lots of naps. Mm. But that doesn't happen often, because I'm one of these people that tends to have like five or six things going at the same time, because you just never know what's going to go forward and what's not going to go forward.
Yeah.
So I try to work on ideas that I'm passionate about. But then I also joke, like, you know, paying the bills and, you know, chasing that next franchise keeps me going. Because as much as I love Final Destination, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be talking about it in 50 years being like, yeah, I wrote Final Destination, you know.
Rest on your laurels.
I mean, I don't want that, you know, like, and I'm very proud of that movie and love to death. But, you know, it's like, I have a couple other franchises in me that I want to get out there.
Sure.
So you know, it's always trying to improve as an artist. I think, you know, as a writer, you know, I think I get better hopefully with every script. And then also now it's gotten to the point where I'm like, you know, I want to make sure the movies turn out like I wrote them, you know, because I do know that I've loved this genre for so long and I do know it. And, you know, I don't certainly think I know it better than anybody else. Like, you know, there are a lot of amazing genre filmmakers out there. But when I write something that I'm really proud of, it's like, now, you know, I want to start being in a position where I can kind of make sure that what I wrote, like, that is translated to the screen in the way that I envisioned it.
Do you have more power nowadays? I guess you've got a proven track record and that you're moving into production.
Yeah. I've definitely, you know, been able to start producing more, and you know, I've had a couple of potential writing or directing things that have kind of been put on hold, or, you know, with financing shifted, so we've had to push it and things like that. So I've had to deal with a lot of this stuff that you don't normally have to deal with as a writer. But it's having been in the business so long, I've learned to kind of navigate that and not let it like set me back. If financing falls through, like I'm upset for a little bit, but I'm not like devastated and going to quit the business. I just start looking for other ways to make sure it happens. Persistence is very key. Persistence and patience, because things don't often work out like we expect them to. But they usually work out for the best.
Horror movies and life.
Yeah, absolutely.
True that. I was thinking about the course of your career, there's been some pretty dramatic shifts in how people consume media. You know, we grew up in the Blockbuster age, but now, like, I know I still go to the cinema. I love the experience. I hate the pricing, but the like so many things now are streaming, and the streaming services are offering these amazing long form. You're not, you know, it's like a series with no commercials. I mean, how is that affecting the writing business? You know, as these things sort of transform the delivery mechanisms.
I think it's overall, I think it's a very good thing, because there are a lot more options out there now for writers, because used to, you know, there were only, you know, a handful of studios. And now you've got, like, you know, Netflix and things and Hulu and Amazon and, you know, Apple TV, and everybody's putting out stuff now. So it's easier to get your content out there. The thing is, there's also a lot more clutter that you have to cut through. And this has always been an issue. My old boss, Bob Friedman at New Line, used to always talk about, when he would speak, about cutting through the clutter. Like, you have to, that's part of being patient and persistent, because there's some, you know, you meet so many writers who are like, I'm coming to LA and I'm going to give it 2 years and I've written 10 scripts, and if I don't sell one of them, I'm going to quit. So you have a lot of those people coming out that are just taking up bandwidth. So you have to kind of stick around long enough to really, you know, rise above. You know, you'd be the last man or woman standing. But it's given a lot more opportunities for creative freedom. So I've definitely, I worked on, you know, my first network show this last season, Midnight Texas, which was a great experience. And it's just opened up, you know, just even doing that has opened up so many more doors for me, because I hadn't been really focused on TV hardcore before then. And it's almost like once you get the foot in the door, then all of a sudden you're in a different club. Then, you know, it's cool. So, and I love the idea that you can take 10 episodes or 12 episodes to tell a movie or tell a story now. So I think it creatively, it's opened up a lot of doors to people. I think it's actually a great thing, you know, and you don't have to sacrifice, you know, creative freedom, because a lot of the studio stuff right now is, you know, everything's like, everybody's so risk averse that, you know, you see a lot of these films that are coming out of the studios that are just like kind of cookie cutter because it's gone through such a development process because nobody wants to take any risks anymore. And then a movie comes out that takes a risk. And I just use Black Panther as an example. You know, like, I've been trying to cast people of color in my films since the first Final Destination. And it's always like, oh, it won't sell overseas. And, you know, you just hear all these excuses. And Blade was actually the first Marvel comic that was a blockbuster. So I always have to give props to Wesley Snipes and New Line and Blade. But, you know, Black Panther came out and, you know, kind of crossed every barrier and was one of the biggest grossing movies of all time. And, you know, so it kind of disproved a lot of the thinking in this business about what people will see. But people, it's still like an anomaly, you know, it's every time there's a movie like that, people treat it like an anomaly. And then, you know, Crazy Rich Asians came out and it's done like gangbusters and cross barriers. And so people are now going, oh, maybe we can make a movie about a different race and everybody will go see it if it's a good story.
Yeah.
It's like, imagine that. So the studios are definitely playing it more safe. And I think in TV, especially with cable and stuff, you're getting the chance to be a lot more creative and take chances, story-wise and with subject matter and stuff that you couldn't get away with in traditional film. So, I think it's been a great boon, but people are still trying to navigate it.
So we're getting to the end of our interview now. We've just got a couple of final questions. So according to IMDb, you're currently filming the movie Superstition, The Rule of Threes right now. Can you tell us about that project a bit?
That project, it's basically based on the superstition that deaths happen in threes. It's my first slasher film. And, it's set on a college campus where two people have died mysteriously and somebody starts a Deadpool, to figure out who's going to be the third person to die. And it ends up being an app that, you know, the students download and they enter, you know, so that also gets rid of that, you know, why don't people use their phones? Because now the killer has access to everybody's phones, and a third person dies, and then somebody starts going after the other people who entered the Deadpool. So it's a really fun slasher film. It's also a film that I wrote that's basically 90%, you know, the cast is people of color. So I just tell people it's like a really good kind of Scream type of slasher film. But instead of focusing on all the pretty white people, we focus on all the pretty brown people and a couple of their white friends. It's just a fun slasher film. And yeah, they shot some of it in Atlanta, and then we're going to be picking back up filming in Louisiana, hopefully end of this year, beginning of next year. So that's going to hopefully be coming out by next Halloween.
Neat.
So I'm really excited about that. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. Just my first slasher film too. It's just kind of,
if you're inverting the fun. If you're inverting the tropes, are you gonna, you know, do all the white people die?
Not all of them, but
it does seem fair. It's only fair.
But one of them dies first. Yeah. But
yeah, I tell you what, if I was a person of color and I realized I was in a slasher movie, I'd be losing my crap. I would be Yeah, I'd be really upset about that. And that's just not fair. So, take it on. Yeah. I'm a big fan of genre movies, but yeah, some of these tropes could be let go, I think, you know. And I could just keep talking. I know we need to wind this up, but I love discussing the writing process and how films are made, because I love movies. And I think our listeners really love monster movies and horror and a lot of this material. So thank you for your insights and talking about behind the scenes stuff. This is great.
No, obviously, and I love talking. So yeah, Anytime you want to have me back on, I'd love to.
If you make it back over here to the East Coast for any of these conventions or something, let me know and I'll come see you.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Dragon Con is our big convention here in Atlanta for fans, and you know they have it's just grown and grown. There's probably about 80,000 people there, and it's all fan related. So.
Oh, cool! Yeah, I've definitely heard of it. Yeah, I'll try to get out to that. And it's so funny. Except for Day of the Dead and Dead Awake, I think we've shot all of my films in Canada.
So, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, all the Final Destinations and Tamara and Return to Cabin by the Lake, they were all shot in Canada. So,
yeah, I guess Atlanta's picking up a lot of film business lately.
Because
Georgia's making it very tax-friendly. All the Marvel movies are here, and it's pretty wild. I noticed when they decided to call Captain America in the latest Avengers movie, he had a 678 area code. That's local. So,
oh, that's so funny.
I want to see Cap. Where's he at? Anyway, that's all right. So we have a question we like to ask all our guests, especially when it's your first visit here. And that is, and I know it's tough to pick sometimes, but what's your favorite monster?
Oh, goodness, that is
Which is your favorite kid, you know?
No.
Only one puppy can survive. Which one?
No, my favorite... You know, this is going to be generic, I think, but, you know, I think my favorite monster, if you're talking about general monsters,
it can be anything you want. I just don't want to exclude anything, right? Anything you want.
Yeah, Freddy Krueger's my favorite movie monster, but I think vampires are my favorite because I grew up on Stephen King, and I think there was just something that was, especially when you're growing up, and you know you're gay and you're trying to figure out who you are and something like that. And there's just something about vampires where they, you know, could live forever and nobody could hurt them, and they didn't kind of discriminate against who they, you know, bit. there's a whole lot of stuff.
Blood is blood.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because I joke about Twilight, you know, I'm like, you know, a woman writes a vampire movie geared towards tweens, and she makes them all like hot guys who like turn into diamonds in the sun. It's like, okay, you're just trying to tick off every cliche for, you know, jewelry and hot guys. But, you know, yeah, I think vampires are kind of, there was just something cool about vampires. Like,
yeah, I like Barlow in the Salem's Lot book. It is.
See, you like the scary ones. I like the Tom Cruise-y, Brad Pitt-y ones.
Oh, no, okay.
No, but I'm kidding. No, Barlow is really scary.
He really is. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm always torn about vampires because very much, and I don't know if I want to blame or rejoice in Anne Rice, but I've enjoyed her books, but she really pushed to make, well, maybe this is a Hammer thing. I mean, I guess Christopher Lee, you know, maybe it's a whole episode about what turned vampires from hideous grave monsters into sexy, you know.
Stylish.
Yeah. So
even Bela Lugosi. Yeah, Bela Lugosi was I'm not saying he's hot. I'm just,
For the time, he was a screen idol.
So. I shouldn't dispel Lugosi. No, but he was like very like sensuous, charismatic kind of vampire. So
I think, I mean, if you look at him, he's not radically different from Valentino in the way he looked. I mean,
no.
Mm-mm. So no, he had that dark, mysterious, and they showed his eyes a lot. It was, you know, I agree. And I don't lament it, although I like my vampires scarier than sexy. I mean, I've read, I think, all of the Anita Blake vampire books, and that's pretty much chick porn. Yeah. I mean, it's at this point, it's there's hardly even... She started out as kind of like a grown-up Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and now she's pretty much a pansexual... The books are not really about mystery so much as they are about who she's having sex with lately. And it's like, and again, going back to I watch rom-coms. My wife, my mom thinks I'm gay. I'm straight, but yeah, I apparently have a very gay taste in music and books and stuff. So.
I told that story on the show before.
I too. Did. Yeah. So, bless her heart. So, but yeah, I've always, I just like my vampires frightening. You know, I like them really frightening and
like
you just like vampires though.
Yeah. Well, I hate to end this because I really like talking to you, but
Jeffrey will have to come back sometime. He's a busy guy.
No, I'd love to. Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you all for having me. And
Thank you so much for joining us, because this has taken a little while to coordinate.
Yeah, too, so. Yeah. I apologize about that.
No worries. Busy.
So, and it was great. It was really cool. And thank you for all your behind the scenes insight and
very interesting.
I think, for any of our listeners who are aspiring writers, just keep writing. You'll get better. You know, that's just don't let the blank page stop you. Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Maybe that's the scariest
awesome.
Monster.
Hopefully some scary.
The blank page. No.
Blank page. Well, hopefully something really scary, well, not too scary, will happen to me before we talk the next time. So then I can be like, oh my God, something really scary happened to me.
Oh, well, I can tell you from personal experience.
Fingers crossed.
You might be better off without it, but.
Okay.
All right. Have a great one. Thanks, everybody.
Awesome. Thank you, Jeffrey. Too. Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
Take care. You too.
Bye-bye.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with screenwriter, producer, and director Jeffrey Reddick. Links to some of his movies and biographical material are on our website at monstertalk.org. Thanks again to Jeffrey for visiting with us, and to Karen for setting this up, and to her husband Matthew for helping with that as well. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed here are those of myself and my guests, and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Monster Talk. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.